Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Women Scholars and Professionals podcast. My name is Anne Boyd, and I'll be your host. We at Women Scholars and Professionals are here to support women in their God-given callings into the university and beyond. So if you're a graduate student or a faculty member, an administrator or a student in professional school, a scholar in between jobs, or simply a person who supports women in the academic world, then this podcast is for you. What can we learn from medieval Christians about Jesus, and how could such ideas connect with our modern-day world? Author and scholar Grace Hammond joins us on the podcast to discuss her book, Jesus Through Medieval Eyes, Beholding Christ with the Artists, Mystics, and Theologians of the Middle Ages. Grace writes about medieval representations of Jesus, highlighting ways that these images can enrich our own faith today. She helps us to see that a deep understanding of these historical concepts allows us to expand our view of God and reveal our own unexplored assumptions, much in the way we grow when learning about other present-day cultures. Grace doesn't shy away from the challenges of studying medieval literature, and at the same time, she paints an appealing picture of the ways our own spiritual understanding can grow through this kind of reading. Her book is lovely, and I really enjoyed my conversation with her. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll hear an excerpt from our conversation where Grace talks about the way she found scholarship and raising tiny children to be mutually beneficial. So let me tell you a little bit more about her. Grace Hammond is a writer and independent scholar of Middle English contemplative writing and poetry. Her writing has been published by both academic and non-academic outlets, including Plow Quarterly and the Journal of Medieval and Early Modern Studies. She celebrates the beauty of literature of the past on her podcast, Old Books with Grace. Grace lives in Denver with her husband and their three young children. So let's dive right in. We're so glad you're here. Well, I want to talk about your book, Jesus Through Medieval Eyes, but first I'd love to start by asking you a few questions about your professional life. So you are a writer and a speaker and a scholar specializing in medieval literature and theology. Can you tell us a little bit of the story of your path into the field?
Sure. I'm an independent scholar. I am not affiliated with an institution right now. And I got my PhD from an English department in Middle English literature. And I had the great fortune of being at Duke, where I could take some seminary classes at the same time as taking my English department classes. So I got this lovely interdisciplinary background that has just been a blessing to me. And now I write and freelance and teach here and there and speak here and there and stay at home with my three young children. That's the shape of my life right now.
It sounds like a great mix of home and scholarly work. How did you become interested in your field, in medieval literature and in Middle English?
I kind of stumbled into it. I guess a lot of interests are that way, where you had no idea and then you come across something and all of a sudden you're hooked. So that was my experience, was that I had always loved history and reading. Reading was my great passion as a kid. That was always my favorite thing to do. In college, I was an English major, and then I thought, oh, I should do something practical. So I switched to being a psychology major, and then it was just not for me. It was a bad fit. And then I was like, what am I doing? I know that it's not practical in any traditional sense, but
Why am I not back in English where I belong with literature, with novels, with poetry? So I doubled, but because by that point I had a zillion psych credits and, couldn't let them go to waste. But I doubled, and then I took my first, I took this class called History of the English Language, and I was totally blown away by in English, in any language, not just English. Our common language is basically like dealing with fossils and with relics of history all the time. And I just thought that was so fascinating. I loved it that our ordinary words have these deep roots and deep histories, and that actually shapes us and shapes how we think, shapes our world. And I particularly loved the era of English called Middle English, which for folks out there is, really closely associated with like Geoffrey Chaucer, author of the Canterbury Tales. So I got really into this era of 14th and 15th century English. And I first got into it because of that language kind of puzzle aspect. But then the more I read Middle English, the more delighted I was by their love of God, and how you can't really read very much Middle English without running into questions about God, adoration of Jesus, and so it opened up this new world for me, especially enthralling at a like highly secular university where talking about Christianity was just not really that cool in an English department, and so it was so fascinating to be encountering this literature within that context, and just I loved it, and then I kind of just kept going, and that's how it went, and I got my doctorate.
Well, so you've spent a fair amount of time in the academic world. What have been some of the gifts of your life in that space and some of the challenges?
Well, I had two pretty different experiences. One, my master's degree was at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and I have this experience of being at this massive state university. That was where my undergrad was too. That was where I first got into Middle English, and then for my doctorate, I went to Duke, which was much smaller, in a totally different part of the United States. Very different feel, that not this like massive place where you're just a cog in the machine. And at both institutions I taught, and that was really a delight, both at both those places. And then I adjuncted a little bit before I stepped away from academia. And so my experiences were that I was so thankful for both of those different places. I think being at such different institutions was a real gift to me because I got to see that people, even though one Duke was a lot more prestigious of an institution than U of A was, but at both places, students were longing to learn and longing to, and they might not have known it themselves even. It was one of those things that you have to, in college is such an experience of unfolding. What do I actually want? Do I want to learn? Do I want to be present, or am I just checked out? And so seeing that same experience at both those places really formed me as a teacher, of okay, you have to help people learn how to desire learning. And so that was a huge experience for me of having these different experiences in academia. One of my most kind of valuable lessons that I've carried with me. And then another thing, a harder thing, was that, obviously it was I had my three children while I was at Duke, and my advisors were super supportive. It worked out really well. That always was a good place. But moving out into the job market and into, I would have liked to be a professor, and for various reasons, didn't choose that path in the end. But having young children and moving forward in academia was very difficult for me, and actually had some quite challenging experiences, not with my graduate program, but with kind of moving out from my graduate program. And so I'd say those are kind of two, the real bright parts, and then some of the harder parts for me as a woman in academic spaces.
Yeah, that's real. I mean, this is a story that we hear a lot. So thank you for sharing that. So as you kind of look back, what advice would you have for a young grad student, someone who's just starting their journey?
I have a very unpopular piece of advice that my own master's advisor gave me, which is don't go into debt for a humanities degree.
Wow.
and I, you know, she was, she basically scared the pants off me and was like, don't do it. It's a mistake. And I know that that ship has sailed for many, but for me, it was a really key piece of advice as I was newly married. We had no, like, that was in the recession when I was headed into grad school. My husband couldn't get a job in his field. And so that advice really saved our skin in a lot of ways.
Wow.
And was a, and is a part that I think people don't talk about in sort of the dream of academia, is that looking for funding at a good institution was a huge boon for me. And part, it became actually part of my own requirements as I moved forward in my degree, is that I said, I'm not going to get a doctorate unless it's fully funded. And that was a good choice for us and for even being able to do some of the things we've been able to do. So that's something I tell folks when they ask me. And I know that it's a little cringy and not very nice to hear, but in this age, especially when jobs are not at all guaranteed on the other end, moving forward in a spirit of freedom, but also a spirit of practicality in that is, I think, a good thing. Another thing is that you are not the dumbest or the smartest one there. And I was so worried. I think a lot of people share this with me in grad programs, that I, you know, imposter syndrome, right? I didn't belong. And I think it took me a long time to get to a point where I was like, Grace, you might not be the smartest person in the room, but you're also, you're here and this is good and you belong here. And I think that that's something that a lot of graduate students, especially women, really struggle with and need to be reminded of. And I know that that was a huge thing for me. So those are kind of the two things of moving forward when you're at those very beginning stages that I would say were really important for me.
That's great. That's great. These are things that we need to hear. So thank you. Well, I am very excited to talk with you about your book. The title is Jesus Through Medieval Eyes, Beholding Christ with the Artists, Mystics, and Theologians of the Middle Ages. And this book was so fascinating to read. I really learned so much from it, and I was delightfully surprised at the ways that it impacts and is relevant to life today. So I would like to begin by asking you to talk about the importance of engaging with medieval ideas about Jesus. You build a compelling case for this in the opening chapters of the book. And I would love for you to walk us through the process of kind of identifying our assumptions and then engaging in the discipline of openness to old books.
So C.S. Lewis has this great introduction to St. Athanasius, who's a, you know, an early church theologian. And he, Lewis writes about how Christians in modernity, and I think even though he was writing in the 50s or the 40s, or whatever, we can equally apply this to ourselves, that we tend to read people of our own time and place, and especially people who agree with us.
Yeah.
So if you're conservative, you're going to be reading more conservative people. If you're liberal, you're going to be reading more liberal people. If you're somewhere in between, you know, all of this affects our choices and how we read and what kinds of ideas are coming to us. And this is all the more apparent in the age of social media, where the algorithm feeds us what we want to be fed at all times. So I think this problem has only gotten more pronounced since Lewis was writing. But so he writes that the only way to, then he says, because of that sort of constant living in the present with people who agree with us, we have certain blind spots. And every culture, this isn't unique to modernity, every culture is going to have those blind spots in terms of truth seeking. So the things that make a lot of sense to us, and then there are things that that we're like, no, that just can't be right because it doesn't match our cultural expectations of something. But that we can combat these blindnesses and these kind of assumptions about the way the world works by reading old books. And so he writes of reading old books as this sort of clean sea breeze that can flow through our minds and kind of clear out some of the cobwebs and assumptions that we have about who people are, who God is, what's important. And so I loved that idea. And for me, medieval people have been a really refreshing way of listening and of learning about my own cultural assumptions and biases and ideas. And it's not that the people of the past are more correct than us necessarily, but it's that they will have keyed in differently on things in the Gospels and in Scripture that we will have overlooked. And then we can take the things that we've learned and usefully, you know, look at that next to what they've said and have a little bit more disruption against our assumptions and challenge to them that, you know, maybe we end up saying, no, I think we're in a good place on this. I like this conclusion. Or we say, wow, I totally missed that. I need to pay more attention to this that I would have never picked up on without reading these old books. So the discipline of openness is kind of this idea that when we're reading old books, that our discomfort and are the places where we trip or where we have to reread or where we're like, oh, I don't know about that, that these are actually places that are extra worth paying attention to because they are places where our own assumptions are sort of being challenged. And often when we read old books, we fall into one of two camps. One is to sort of worship everything that the person of the past says. Like, oh, they must be so much smarter, or they know better because they were in the past. It's this sort of attitude of, you know, the past is always going to be better. So that's, some people have that while they read, and other folks have this sort of need to constantly correct the past as you read. This suspicion that, oh, wow, okay, medieval folks, for instance, are all going to be misogynistic, even the women, because that was the culture they lived in. And so do we then not ever read medieval books because they were biased against women? And that's not me saying that as a, like, as a crusading feminist, that's just factual of the way that they were writing and thinking about women as literally inferior as spiritual and physical to men. So what we do then as we read is we try to not get defensive, not get aggressive either with our own viewpoint, but kind of sit with it a little bit and wait and see what happens. And this is this can be a hard stance to hold, but in the end, though we'll reject some things, other things that we initially would have been like suspicious of may end up being really valuable to us as we pursue the truth of God.
This tension, I really felt even just reading your descriptions and some of the excerpts, because I would feel myself getting defensive. I would feel myself saying, you know, in my mind, no, I don't want to accept that. But I think I hear you saying that if we can sit in kind of a non-judgmental space with it for a minute, it helps to illuminate some of our own assumptions. And we're maybe not going to necessarily take on the view that the medieval writer is offering, but that there is something to be learned.
That's right. And I think too, maybe it also makes it easier to understand if we think of these writers of the past, whether they're medieval or patristic or whatever, as fellow people, that if we were sitting with somebody over coffee at a table, we wouldn't immediately be jumping down their throat when they were expressing a thought that we hadn't thought about before. And so if we can move ourselves into a place of I'm sitting at coffee with Julian of Norwich or with St. Thomas Aquinas, and I'm just listening to what they have to say before I interject and say, well, that can't be right, or that blah blah blah. That makes sense to us because that's how we form relationships and think together as people in our living bodies right now. And that we can also have conversation like this with the past is a startling and then kind of exciting way of thinking about reading.
Well, let's get into some of the images that you bring forth in your writing. Your book is structured around several depictions of Jesus, and you show him taking on roles that are different from what we often expect in our modern day faith traditions. So, could you just walk us through a couple of them?
Sure. So some of these portrayals will be very familiar to us, even if we don't talk about them too much. So the one that I start the book with is the image of the judge, which has been important to Christians since Jesus himself was preaching and teaching. And so this is a very ancient image, and it's one that I don't know about you, but I have trouble associating it with anything other than kind of street preachers or a fire and brimstone tradition. That was one image that I had to really sit with and think very seriously about for a while before I felt confident writing about it, because it's a toughie. But at the same time, it's at the heart of our tradition, and you can't, if you just ignore it, it's not going to go away. It's still there. So what do you do with it? So that was one. Another one that is more familiar but also strange to us, that is also ancient, is the lover or the bridegroom. And so that was another chapter. And then I have some others that are more unusual to us, that still have scriptural and historical roots, but that we just don't use in the church typically in modernity today. So one of those is the knight, Jesus as a knight, jousting with death, or another is the mother. So Christ as a mother giving birth on the cross to the church. And these are both images with scriptural roots, metaphors with deep resonance, but that we just don't think about regularly. So those were both very fascinating to write and to read and research.
Yeah, a lot of them just felt really countercultural and surprising and fresh, and I felt a little embarrassed reading the chapter about the lover, and it's just super interesting. Yeah.
It's
But really, really, really interesting. One of the things I loved about your writing is that you describe art throughout the book, and you also in the text you include images of art. Can you say a little bit about the role of art in the spiritual lives of medieval Christians?
Yeah. So, art and its role in how we understand God has always been a conflicted area of debate for folks. So the Greek or the Orthodox tradition and the Western tradition had parted ways on this, and there was all kinds of conflict. But at the same time, art was held to be a very important piece of learning, of spiritual learning and growth in the lives of ordinary Christians, partially because of the lack of literacy, of widespread literacy in the church for a very, very long time, really until the advent of the printing press. Because, if you think back to widespread books, Books were luxury items. A lot of people would not have encountered them at all, except via their church and their priest. And if you were a monk or a nun, you would have had more access to books because a lot of monasteries and convents had libraries. So, and then there were, of course, the universities were born in the Middle Ages. So that was developing. But for most people, to sit down and have a daily quiet time with your, you know, hot beverage and your Bible open in front of you would never, never have happened. Right. and so images, Pope Gregory the Great writes to a friend, images are like scripture for the illiterate, basically. Mm. And he saw them as a really important teaching tool, because we associate actual illiteracy with biblical illiteracy. But the fact of the matter is that medieval people knew a lot about scripture and they were drawing it from images. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the interiors of like great medieval cathedrals, where every sort of inch of wall space is covered in narrative, and that's narrative of the Bible or narrative of the saints. And so that was how a lot of people were learning, besides, of course, preaching and teaching of their spiritual advisors. So images were hugely important to the ordinary person in learning about what the church was teaching about the character of God.
Yeah. Well, you also write about the problem of white Jesus, of this depiction of Jesus as white. And you talk about the challenge that comes in any culture when a depiction of Jesus just reflects the character or the values of one particular culture, so that it stops really resembling, you say it stops the resemblance to the second person of the Trinity, right? So how do we, I mean, both in looking at medieval art and also just in even current day ideas and depictions, how can we approach that difficulty?
Yeah, I think this is a tough question that has a lot of variability. I think for one, it is every culture is going to depict Jesus in their own image to some extent. And so in all this medieval European art, Jesus is occasionally a little bit darker skin, but most of the time he is definitely of European descent. Right. And Mary even more so. Mary is almost always very, very pale. And so, you know, holding that and acknowledging that, but also acknowledging that every culture has done this at different points. And the problem emerges is when you kind of prioritize that vision and version of Jesus over other versions. So yeah. No, Jesus is absolutely this blonde surferish dude that we often see in American mid-century art, which is probably the influence that most of us have grown up with most of all. And so walking into this knowledge that we are always going to make Jesus more similar to us than we should.
Mm-hmm.
But also knowing that Christ came to us in humanity, so that we are also, by seeing ourselves in him, actually thinking incarnationally in certain ways, that's a tension that you can't escape and that you have to hold together. And so, you know, I think one way to combat this, the downside of the dark side of this today, is by looking at a lot of different forms of art of Christ and not getting too attached to one version. And it's actually, I think, because we're also more aware of this than we used to be, that sometimes it's even more dangerous in writing than in art, because in art, it's much easier for us now to say, Well, Jesus was a Jewish man living in the Middle East. I kind of know what that's going to look like. I have a pretty good mental image of that. It's going to be more insidious and sneaky in the ways in which we write about him with our values. And so that ends up being more challenging for us in certain ways. And of course, there's always going to be really egregious moments where it's very obvious. So I'm thinking of January 6th and some folks holding up pictures of Jesus in the midst of violence. And you're like, well, that seems pretty counter to a crucified God. That doesn't match at all. But it's going to come out in much more subtle ways. So in the medieval texts I write about, in this, there was a very popular tradition of writing about the life of Christ, and little bits of medieval life make their way into that. So writing of Jesus is having these really genteel nobleman table manners, where you're like, there's something really charming and human about that. But also I have to hold that with knowing that it's a cultural value coming out in the text.
Well, I was struck by your chapter on the wounded God, where you talk about the contrast between our current day understanding of suffering and that of medieval Christians. And you write, "I'm deeply cognizant that one of the biggest differences between medieval people and myself is that while they may glorify suffering to a fault, I see it only cause for dread and avoidance." I would love for you to tell us a little bit about ways that we can grow as we study the medieval response to suffering.
Yeah, this is a really challenging thing that I'm still totally wrestling with in my faith and in my scholarship is one of the biggest cultural differences, maybe the biggest difference between medieval Christianity and ourselves is this attitude towards suffering. And for me, what has been helpful, really helpful, is that it reminds me that we live in this almost completely suffering avoidant culture. And by we, I mean American, maybe Western as a whole, Christians, where even things that are like minor level suffering, like waiting in line at the DMV or waiting for a web page to refresh or, fill in the blank, any of those waiting in the longest line at the grocery store, any of these really, really small things. We have learned to treat with, what can we do at any cost to eliminate laborious suffering? And I think that what medieval Christians have been teaching me is that this is a mistaken way of looking at a lot of suffering, that there is growth and value in being present in discomfort. And now that's not like a universal hard and fast rule. I think there's a lot of suffering that is good to avoid. But that to look for what is being offered in a moment of irritation, annoyance, even some forms of pain. That there are often things offered there that can't be learned in other ways. And we know this on a very basic level. So an image that Julian of Norwich, who's one of my favorite medieval writers, uses is this image of a child falling down and how that actually you think of when a child is learning to walk and falling down and balance are part of the actual learning process of balance and walking and then running and then playing and all this big arc. But falling is actually an incorporated part of that. And I think a lot of what we treat just with extreme distaste actually is more like a child falling at, and should be understood as part of our own growth and spiritual development as we too learn to run and to play and agility. And so that's what I've been thinking about a lot. And what I think medieval Christians were exploring in their extreme and intense focus on the wounds of Jesus and on Christ's broken body and blood on the cross is that there is this this real, really difficult and challenging beauty there that is actually waiting for us in our own woundedness. Henry Nouwen talks about it. I just read this portion where he talks about befriending our brokenness and seeing it as this part of ourselves that is just as precious in certain ways. Not that sin is good, but as much part of us as our belovedness by God, our blessedness, our chosenness, our brokenness is a part of ourselves too. Wow. And that God is working in each of us in those broken places. So I think that feels very medieval, that idea.
Mm-hmm. I really, I mean, that word distaste, I think that really sums up the way we look at pain. And I think we have a lot of fear too.
Yes, absolutely.
And I can see, just like from my, you know, the little that I know of medieval literature and, you know, saints who wrote at that time, that, that there's not that sense of fear, that, you know, that there is something about, being able to look at the wounds of Jesus or to face suffering that, that shows you strength and draws you closer to God rather than, oh my gosh, let's avoid this at all costs.
Right, exactly. And I think of this, I was just reading 1 Peter with a small group and we were laughing because in 1 Peter, he says, why are you surprised when hard things happen to you? And we were laughing because we're like, we're always surprised when hard things happen to us. Like, we're always like, wait, are you serious? This is part of the deal of living. That's horrible. And want to avoid that. And that's totally human and understandable. But I think medieval folks had a much more kind of robust understanding because of their closeness to death and disease and hardship in a way that we as in middle class America are very, you know, have distanced ourselves from immensely. Yeah. They were just less surprised and more ready to look for God in it, in a way that's different than us.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really liked about your book was the way at the end of each chapter, you offer some suggestions to help the reader practice and explore ways of connecting with these kind of fresh new visions of Jesus. And I feel like even this conversation has given us some of those. But can you give a few suggestions of ways that listeners could connect with these ideas?
Yeah. So I have at the end of each chapter different like scriptural passages for reading. And then I have these different practices. And so some of them are really like kind of simple. You know, with the lover, a lot of this imagery of Christ as a bridegroom is coming out of the Song of Songs and reading the Song of Songs allegorically as the tale of an encounter of love between Christ as the bridegroom and the soul as bride, whether the soul is regardless of the soul's gender. And so, but so much of the imagery in that book is nature imagery and especially and food imagery. So one of the practices in that chapter, for instance, is going on a walk and just paying attention to nature and what it is saying. And if it's bad weather, go to a grocery store and just look at the produce and the fruit and the bright colors. And so they're very simple practices. They're not very, you know, spiritually elaborate, but that kind of idea of paying attention. And I think in these visions of Jesus, in these different roles, a lot of it just comes, a lot of the insight of these just comes from paying attention. So when you're reading a book or watching a movie that aren't even pre-modern, but that are just regular from today, what is standing out to you? You know, what is worth paying attention to? What is bothering you? These are places where we often can easily skate by. But when you're paying attention to what is beautiful about something, you often reach surprising new insight about the character of God via the character of what he has created. And that's a very medieval practice in and of itself. They saw that God revealed himself in everything that he has created in different ways.
Yeah.
And so what is, as cheesy as it sounds, what is this tree telling you about the character of Jesus? What is this bird? What is your child's meltdown? What is, you know, all those things will tell you things if you are paying attention. And that's what medieval folks believed. And that's what I have come to believe too.
Yeah. I'm so curious to know more about how your study of medieval literature impacts your own spiritual life. I mean, we've heard a lot about it, but is this, I mean, how do you see it kind of popping up from day to day?
Oh, it's hugely impactful, informative for me. Probably in the deepest sense, I've mentioned Julian of Norwich already multiple times, but her, I really consider her one of my main spiritual teachers. And I think one of the really wonderful things about reading the folks of the past is that, by the way, folks of the present too, but it's just, it's extra funny when it happens across centuries, is that you discover these people who uniquely speak to you, right? Who are not just wonderful and wise in their own right, but actually become your teacher and your friend in a very real way. And that's how I feel about a lot of these medieval writers, but especially Julian, is that I have now read her so much, and that she's kind of become one of the guides in my mind, right? As her words have really formed me on a deep level. And so she changed how I see the crucifixion. She changed how I understand the character of the love of God. Those are just a couple of the ways in which I feel like she has taught me, just like how a spiritual advisor or a pastor or priest would teach me today. And she's one of several, but she's the main one. And so I think that's one of the joys of reading with the discipline of openness, is that you meet new teachers who have things to tell you that can change how you think and how you react and how you interact. And so that's a joy that somebody from 600 years ago could have that with you. And so that's been a really wonderful gift for me.
I love that. Well, I'm thinking about our listeners now, you know, women in academic and professional contexts, and about their engagement with this book. So what might be one thing that you could highlight, particularly for women who are in academic spaces as they approach taking a look at your book? What might be something that would be especially interesting to them or speak to their hearts?
Well, I think I hope that I speak as one of them, so that you will hopefully maybe find a little bit of yourself in here as you read, because one of the things I talk about is how all of us are, there's no such thing as sort of a universal reading. All of us are reading out of our own time and places and even individual bodies and experiences. And so the things that strike you as important, profound, lovely, horrifying, are all inflected by that context out of which you're reading. And so I probably have some things in common with many of you who are women in academic and professional spaces. So you may find some of yourself in there as you read. And I hope too, one of the things that I try to bring is this keen sense of curiosity. And I think a lot of us in academia share that and value that, and desire to pursue that sort of love of learning. And that I hope and think suffuses Jesus through medieval eyes.
Yeah. So Grace, how can our listeners follow you and your work? What are you working on? What's coming up for you? Things like that.
Yeah. So on the practical level, how you can find me and follow me, I'm on social media. I have an Instagram at Old Books with Grace. I have Twitter at Grace Hammond, PhD. And I have a Substack that has like kind of little bits and tastes of medieval things. It's called Medievalish, and that's at gracehammond.substack.com. What I'm working on right now is I actually have a new book project in the works, continuing my medieval obsession naturally, on the vices and the virtues. And so that'll be coming out in a while, you know, fall of 2025, but that's been what's on my mind lately. And you'll find bits and pieces of that filtered, in my Substack right now. So yeah.
I love that. Super. And you have a podcast too.
I do have a podcast. Thank you for reminding me to say that. I have a podcast called Old Books with Grace, where I have different series on literature of the past, not just medieval literature, but kind of anything older than 50 years. And I also have interviews with authors who are working on scholarship of these books or who are, you know, adjacent or just fans. A lot of us are just fans of old books and like, yay, that's so fun. So
that's great. I loved Grace's encouragement to sit with the writings of medieval Christians and learn from them. I'm inspired to check out Julian of Norwich and maybe even meet a new teacher of my own. I hope you check out her book, which you can find wherever books are sold. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll get to hear a bonus from our podcast where Grace talks about the way she found scholarship and raising tiny children to be mutually beneficial. The Women Scholars and Professionals podcast is hosted by me, Anne Boyd, and is a production of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. We acknowledge that the opinions of our guests may not necessarily represent the ministry, doctrine, or policies of InterVarsity. You can find more information about our podcast and the other cool things we are doing at thewell.intervarsity.org. Our work is funded solely through the donations of our listeners and supporters, so if you enjoyed this podcast, you might consider joining our support team by donating even $10 per month. You can find out how to do this at our website. To ensure others will find and enjoy our podcast as well, please consider rating and reviewing our podcast and sharing it with others. And as we close, listen in on this excerpt from my conversation with Grace. So, Grace, you mentioned that, you know, you have three children and you had them when you were in grad school. It's just such a challenge. And I'm wondering if you have any reflections on that. What was it like? Do you have any tips for people who are in a similar space?
I have a lot of thoughts on this. But I will keep myself limited to a few. One is that it was super important for me that, and it helped me so much that my professors and advisors were very supportive of me and gave me a lot of flexibility. And so I just want to give them a major shout out because I know people that it wasn't that way for them.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing that I want to just acknowledge. But secondly, I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I chose that decision. And I know that's not for everybody, but for me, it was really good. And it actually fed my scholarship to be raising little tiny babies at the same time as writing and thinking. It felt like each part of my life was feeding the other part. And yes, it definitely meant I had way less time. I had to be really disciplined. I had to make some serious sacrifices. But this part of myself that was learning and growing as a mother was speaking deeply to this part of myself that was learning and growing as a scholar.
Wow.
And I became a better writer. I became more thoughtful and deliberate with a lot of what I was doing. And so for me, it was this very rich experience of spiritual and emotional growth in the midst of the tension and the hardship of learning how to manage life. But it actually fed my scholarship, which it was surprising to me and surprising to other people too, I think. So I think, you know, sometimes for us as scholars, it's tempting to, we love the life of the mind. And so to be kind of thrust into this very intense life of the body experience at the same time, in pregnancy and in caring for children was a good balancing.
Yeah. I mean, I know for myself that I became so much more efficient in any work that I had to do. It was
just because you have to be, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not optional anymore.
Right.